we have been given a little bit of a basic introduction to the concepts of Shtar. Let's flesh it out a little bit more and see how it fits into our mission over here and what's going on. So first of all, we had to try to figure out how does the concept of the Shtar reconcile itself with the idea that the PM below the Peak Sabam, so we saw the Rebbeinu Tam, says that it's only an exclusion of Elaim, essentially it's a halacha in the aid rather than this process specifically, and theoretically one could be made through written documents, and then we discussed yesterday in a little bit more detail that that would be different than a shtar. That a shtar has a certain status to it, while testifying through writing doesn't necessarily have the same rules. So, for example, if the aid no longer remembers the testimony, and he's only remembering it because of what's written down, so that would not work for later testimony through writing, although a shtar under such circumstances is kosher. And we also mentioned the Baal HaMor. So just to see a little bit more about the context of the Baal HaMor, this is a little bit longer of a Maamar Makom, so I didn't put it all down, but you can look it up when you have a chance. So this is all in Yevamos, and Daf Tes B'Daf Be'Harif, around the Gemara, around Daf Lamed Aleph, that there the Gemara says that it's a problem for Eidim to write down their testimony, because we're worried that if they even have this written testimony, then they may use it later, and that's a problem, use the document later, and that's a problem of Mipihem V'lom Mipichsavam. So that's a part of where the Rishonim are trying to figure out, so when is it okay, when is it not okay, and how does that match with the Gemara on Daf Chaf, where the Gemara says that one can have a document to refresh his memory later on. So there is the Baal HaMor that we mentioned, but the Baal HaMor is in the middle of the Rif and the Ramban. So the Rif has an approach that the issue is that there's a difference between a shtar that emanates from the Eidim and one that emanates from the Baal HaDin, let's say from the Malva. The Malva has a shtar, and the shtar is testified to by Eidim from the time it was signed. So then, that's okay. That's not a problem of Mipihem V'lo Mipichsavam when he brings this shtar. But the if the Eidim are going to disseminate a shtar, so then that's essentially them testifying, and they're testifying through writing. That becomes the problem of Mipihem V'lo Mipichsavam. That part is in the Rif. And then the Baal HaMor expresses his position that it's basically Mipif Sabav below Mipif Sabav. That the Psul is that the Eidim should not be expressing themselves through writing, but the Baal Din can express himself through writing. So essentially, the Shtar, and Soloveitchik emphasized his position very strongly, and Rav Schechter and his Kutras about shtaros, which is available in the Sefer Eretz HaTzvi, understands essentially that's what a shtar is for these purposes. A shtar is the das hamischayev. And it's basically the person who's taking on the debt. Let's say, for example, the borrower who writes a shtar for the malva. And so the lova gives the shtar to the malva has the shtar. So that represents the das hamischayev, the lova's willingness to acknowledge a debt to the lender based on the testimony of the witness. And that aspect of being a das hamischayev seems to be, as the Rav focused on especially, the key defining element of what the shtar is. So that's not necessarily at odds with the point that the Rav was making. And if you look at the Ramban over there, which you can add to the Makoros when you get up to it, that the Ramban essentially kind of fills in the picture. The Ramban says, still, we have to deal with the fact that the Gemara says that the Eidim shouldn't write down their testimony and have it with them because we're afraid that they're going to testify based on that. So if you put these positions together, essentially, the Rif and the Baal HaMor, now the Ramban, that essentially the issue is the shtar should represent the das hamischayev and should be given to the other party. If it's going to hang around with the Eidim, and then it's going to be the Eidim who are disseminating it. So then that becomes an issue of Yipihem Vlom Yipsav. Okay, so far so good. So within that context of having a shtar, so now we enter into this environment of a requirement of kiyum shtaros, and that Chazal, as we saw yesterday, all the different examples of what can qualify as a kiyum shtar. We saw the Rambam has five different ways that a Beis Din can decide that the shtar is mekoyim. And now what we have to see looking at our Mishnah is what exactly are we trying to accomplish through that. So what we're going to try to do in the time that we have today is identifying some of the key issues that come out of this Mishnah. There are many. And hopefully set the stage for discussing them further. And this topic of the different methodologies, maybe we'll come back to this. I just noticed, we mentioned the other day, the fascinating writings of Gitzler Zilberstein, Sefer Chashuk Yechemet. So he has a shayla here. He always has these fascinating shaylas. So what happens if the Beis Din decides that the signatures are good, and then a graphologue comes in and says that they're not good? Right? What's a graphologue? A handwriting expert. Right, a graphologist. So let's say the graphologist comes and decides that the handwriting actually does not match the Eidim. So what exactly is the status? Does he have the ability to therefore negate the kiyum shtaros of Beis Din based on that? So he has a little discussion, so maybe we'll come back to it. It's a fascinating issue in general. So let's now look at the Mishnah. Right? So the Mishnah says, Ha'edim sha'amru, k'sav yadeinu huzeh. So the Edim say, yes, you know what? This is our handwriting. That seems like it was us. However, they add something else. They say, we were disqualified witnesses. Aval anusim hayinu. Right? That it was not true what we signed. We were forced to sign it. And the Gemara is going to discuss different types of anusim, which is going to make a big difference. Right, what kind of possibly saw the Gemara a little bit? What kind of different anusims could you be? What does it mean to be an honest? How could you be honest in this case? Yeah? So one, that would be anusim machlus nefashos. Right? So somebody puts a gun to your head and says, sign the shtar, or you're in trouble. And what's the other possibility? Anusim machmas mamon. So, what's the difference between those two cases? They're radically different, as the Gemara is going to tell us, right? What's the difference between those two cases? Morty?
Anusim machmas mamon, so if you say that you signed because the guy held you for money, then you're a Russian.
So it seems like you have a right to claim that an honest person allow you to write such a shtar. So if you have some kind of monetary pressure that is pushing you to falsely testify to a document, and this is the right, so this is the halachah, you can cause a hefset to somebody else in violation of the Torah because you were forced with some kind of monetary pressure. So what right do you have to do that? So that seems to be an aver. Right, so first of all, how does that factor into things? And the other possibility, anusim machmas nefashos, so then presumably you did have to sign it. And then while that may call into question the accuracy of the facts in the shtar, it may at least preserve your own status as a kosher aid, at least theoretically. However, we'll see, there's an opinion in the Gemara, and this is a fascinating discussion of itself, that creates the possibility. Maybe it's a question of how you read it, but a lot to say, just kind of identifying the issues now, that maybe even on threat of death, you shouldn't sign a false shtar, right? Which is very hard to understand. We're not aware that this is one of the horrible yavors, and unless somehow it could fit into the model of halachas of horrible yavor, so that's a fascinating discussion, which is also one of the many, many topics that emanates from this Mishnah. So that's one thing we have to figure out. Right? So when they say anusim, so how could you be an onus? What's the difference between the different types of onus? And is there even a possibility that onus machmish nefashos does not exonerate the person from such a decision? That's one major topic that's going to come up. But if you say anusim machmas mammon, so clearly that's not a legitimate choice. So then that brings up other issues, which the Gemara is also going to bring up. Right, what other sugya is provoked by that? If somebody testifies, I signed falsely. Yeah?
And then
makes him atzma rasha, right? So basically, you're going to come in court and testify that you did an avera. Right? Since when are you allowed to do that? Right? So that's another major sugya which is going to come out of this Mishnah. Right? To what extent does the individual have the nemanus to declare himself an avera? Right? We normally say you don't have such nemanus. Say no, then makes him atzma rasha. Now, think about this for a second, and you'll see another issue that comes out of this Mishnah. Why might you say we should accept it? Even if we have a principle that an individual cannot declare himself a Rasha, cannot establish himself as a Rasha, so why shouldn't we say that this might work anyway? Just logically, without any makoros, why might there be room to accept such testimony, even in light of the principle they know the Mesa a Rasha?
Perhaps the purpose of someone who can't do that to themselves is that they can't be prosecuted for their crime committing, but it can affect the trustworthiness of the shtar that's separate from that.
Okay, so you're on the right track. So, I mean, you're correct, basically, but even that you can break down into two halves. Right? So again, just in terms of what issues are on our agenda for this mission, so one issue is it could be that I know the Mesa Matzla Russia is a localized principle, that it just means that you cannot get yourself in trouble through your testimony. You can't self-incriminate. So if it was a question of an onish that you are theoretically eligible for, so your testimony cannot get that onish for you. But maybe it doesn't really address the validity of what you're claiming. It means that essentially you're immunized from any prosecution based on what you're saying. Or, if you want to say that it really means more than that, that simply we don't believe you at all to establish yourself as a Rasha, still, there's another possibility. Right? There's a possibility called Palbinan Dibure. Right? Do we say that when somebody is making a claim that has two components to it, and one component he has a block against being believed, is it possible that we can isolate the factors and say, all right, you're not believed for this part, but you are believed for another part? So, is that possible? Can you distinguish between the two? That's another major sugya that's going to emerge from this mission. And you have that issue anyway, even without the sanusim, because if you continue with the Mishnah, so the Mishnah says, Kitanim hayinu, like maybe you'll claim that you were a cardinal at the time, so you were not kosher edus for that reason. Right? Which now is a whole different point. Right? Now you're saying that the shtar might be factually accurate, but I'm not qualified to have said so. So it's a shtar without aid. It's a very, very significantly different claim than the first one. But the next line is subject to a machlokis and rishonim because of the point that we just said. What if you say psuli edus hayinu? Right. So what does that mean to say psuli edus? So if you see Rashi, we'll get into this a little bit more. So Rashi says krovin, oh misachkin bekubia. Right, that it's a very interesting choice of words. Right, because why were you possible to eat this? So, by saying, if you just said you were crowed, so okay, so then you're not incriminating yourself in any way. You have the right to be a crow. You're just not a kosher eat under those circumstances. So maybe that's what it means. But if you put in another psul, like a psul of, you say you were a shy. So then again, the question comes up that are you gamma to say that? If you claim that you were a Rasha, so you're possible atheist, so should you have the credibility to say that? Or can we say that we'll accept it just in terms of possible mishtar, but not in terms of anything else? So some of the Rishonim, as we'll discuss, say that no, you can't bring in anything else here besides Krovim, because any other type of soul, you're going to bring up issues of another Mason Atzma Rasha. Right? We shouldn't believe you if you say that you were possible. So this is another twist on the Mason Atzma Rasha issue. Now it's interesting, Rashi doesn't bring up Rishus per se. Rashi mentions Mesachik Tukubia, which you could question. The Gemara in Sanhedrin says, and Masechta Kumbia, let's say for lack of a more specific translation, we'll call him a gambler right now. So a gambler, the Gemara says, Pasul Eidus, but it's not the worst person you could think of. You know, it's one of the categories of Pasul Eidus. I mean, it could be that Rashi Badavka is not going for a full-blown Russia when he says Pasul Eidus more than just a karma. And, for example, the Gemara has two different theories as to why the Sakhavu could be as Pasul Eidus. It could be that we could turn that as something short of rishus, but still something that creates a disqualification. So is an Eid Neman to say he's in this category that may not be rishus, but apostles and lay Eidus. Hi.
I think in Rosh Hashanah, we find that a Sakhavu Kovia can testify about the new moon. So we find that he is believed in certain cases.
So to some extent, he has, you know, he's not a completely apostle aid. So is that why Rashi picked that example, Dafka, as opposed to an actual Russia? And why does the Tosfos Rit, for example, say that even that example is too much? It's got to be just a curve. Okay, so with all these issues, so if they state all this, so Hare Elu Ne'amanim. Right, so basically they have Ne'amanus to say that and therefore declare the shtar no good. But if there are other Eidim who come and say that this is their handwriting, or there's another reason to validate the shtaros, there's another source of the shtaros, if it's not coming from them, then we don't believe them. So we have here a fascinating interaction of different principles here. Right? So what exactly, somebody explain to me, what are the potential clashes here? How exactly are forces being pitted against each other? The first part of the Mishnah, the second part of the Mishnah. Now, what's the mechanics of the first part of the Mishnah? Why is it different to the second part of the Mishnah?
All right. It seems to be that if they come on their own to affirm the Kiyum Ashtar, to affirm the signatures, and then they show what, and then they come to undo it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like Pesha Asur, Pesha Hit,
which right.
We mentioned in the previous Mishnah.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, any Rishon say that over here?
Rashi.
Rashi says exactly that, that essentially what we have here at work is Pesha Asur. Right, that since the whole credibility of the Shtar comes from their own admission. If they undermine that admission, so then they have the authority to do that, because Hapesh Asar who Hapesh Hiddu. Okay, continue.
And then if other people or other documents are able to affirm it instead of them, mm-hmm. then they are no longer the Pesha Asar, so they can't be the Pesha Hiddu.
Okay, so then if other Eidim come and they're the ones who are Mekayim Shtar, right? So then, we're not coming from Pesh Asar. The question is, what are we coming from? Right? So, okay, so it's not Pesh Asar, but who says those other Eidim should be any more credible than the first Eidim? Right? So what is the dynamic? It's not Pesh. First, let's assume for a second that the first case is Pesh Asar, which is how Rashi presents it, but you know, could be other ways of understanding it as well, right? So you see this Rashi, Reil Ne'amanim. Rashi says, "Kevan de ink sab yodam nikar ella al pihan." Since there's no other source telling you that it's kasher, hapesh asar hu hapesh hitir ki hechi de mehemnis lahu aha mehemnis aha. But since we believe them that it's their handwriting, we also believe them for the other aspects that it was under these circumstances that cast dispersions on the shtar. So Rashi says straight out, it's hapesh asar function. But that's, let's say, in terms of the first case, and assuming that Rashi is right, again, there might be other ways to read it. But, so what happens in the second case? So what are the dynamics in the second case? The Pesha Asar is not a factor. So what is a factor? What's happening? What's going on in the second case? How are we adding up the parts here?
It seems like their believability becomes lessened because they are no longer that Pesha Asar. And therefore, since we have other people who are affirming the signature, and they had affirmed their signature as well, it doesn't overcome their testimony of their own self-possibleness.
Doesn't overcome their own testimony.
Their next testimony about about how it's not
okay, I think we're getting at, but just to sharpen it a little bit more, right? That essentially what I'm trying to figure out is, so in the second case where Pesh also doesn't play in as much or at all, so what are the factors? So you have this eight, these eight from saying Shara's over there. Who is against them? Is it, are they against these two other Edom? Is that the idea? Is it Trey Utrey, basically? And if so, so what should the consequence be? Who should we believe if it's two sets of Edom against each other? Or maybe these two Edom are not against the new set of Edom. Who else might they be against? They might be against themselves, right? That essentially they are the Edom on the shtar. So if that's the case, if the shtar is upheld, so then the shtar becomes its own source of evidence. And maybe whatever they're coming to say now is not strong enough to overcome the shtar. Which, ironically, you know, they're the ones who put the shtar into motion in the first place. So that becomes a fascinating question. What exactly is the dynamic of this fight? Are they, is it essentially the Edom against themselves? Is it the Edom against another set of Edom? Is it a tray to tray? Or is this essentially a shtar that remains in its tokef because these new Edom have no premise to contradict it? So that, the idea that the Edom are against themselves, that opens up a whole other sugya, another fascinating sugya that comes out of this Mishnah. Anyone know what I'm referring to? There's a principle called Kevan Shehigin Shuv Eino Chozer Umagi. Right, that in general, an aid is not Naman to go against himself. And so if you had given official court-validated testimony, so under normal circumstances, if you come and now say the opposite, the second testimony is not believed. We don't accept a recanting of the testimony under normal circumstances. So that is a whole other sugya which is going to come out of this Mishnah, because that could essentially be the dynamic, right? That essentially it's not so much in the second part of the Mishnah, it's not so much that we have a clash between the two Edom we're talking about and the other two Edom who are affirming their writing on the shtar. We have a clash between the Edom and themselves. Right, that essentially the shtar represents their initial edus, and now they're coming to reverse the edus. We don't accept the reversed edus. We don't have such an ability to take back your edus. That's kevin shehigid shuvena chozer man. So essentially that becomes yet another major sugya that is emerging from this Mishnah, and we have to figure out exactly how that works. Now, another question. And see, Tosfos is going to ask over here, and this ties into some of the points. If we look at this Tosfos for a second, Tosfos, Hari Elu Ne'amanin. Right? So he asks Tosfos on the first case of the Ne'aman, right? The first part of the Mishnah. So says Tosfos, V'yim Tomar V'lama Ne'amanin. Right? We shouldn't believe them. Why? Because now they have another problem. V'hav Migo B'makom Edim Hu. Right, that essentially Tosfos is assuming it's a Migo. Let's assume that basically Pesh Asar equals Migo according to Tosfos here. Right, this is an issue we had earlier in the parak. Is Pesh Asar and Migo the same principle or not? So presumably they're invoking Migo as a reference to the Pesh Asar. Migo, they could have said nothing. So whatever credibility we should give them for that in the first premise, so isn't that against Aiden? So does Migo have enough Ne'amanas to contradict witnesses? So who are the Edom in that case? Themselves. Right? That basically the initial kashrus of the shtar comes from the Edom, and now we want to validate a conflicting view based on Migo. So essentially it's a Migo versus Edom. How could you believe such a thing? How could you accept that? And Tosfos goes on to explain, Da'anan Sadi Shlo Hayu Anusim V'lo Psuli Edus. Right, that we are witnesses, so to speak. So you could say maybe the other Edom are not themselves, but are us representing themselves, that we now can take it as self-evident that if the shtar exists with their signature, so then it's valid. So what right do they have? So we are on inside the shloya nusagulopsuliate. And the halakamanim read and trade the train. You know, later on we'll have to see this gemara a little bit inside because it's a little complicated in context. But later on the gemara is gonna classify this as 2 versus 2, 2 eight versus 2 eight. That's Tosus's initial question. There's a lot to figure out about this Tosus question. We just want to kind of introduce it into evidence, so to speak. So Tosus goes on to say here a key point. To get into the whole kiyum shtaris issue, of yesh lomar kevan shitzrichu chachamim kiyum hacha lo chashiv klal kiyum masha omrim ksav yedenu huzeh. Right. So since Chazal have imposed a requirement of kiyum shtaros, so now what they're saying doesn't count as kiyum shtaros, because even though they're saying it's our handwriting, kevan deinu gufayu amri toch kedei dibur. Since they say in the same breath, they say that we were too young or we were forced. So then that's not considered to be a kiyum shtar. So the rest of Tosfos contrasts this later. Don't look at that right now. But what do you see from Tosfos now? That essentially the effect of the Takanas Chachamim to require kiyum shtaros makes it that without the kiyum shtaros, you don't have the shtar. So essentially the shtar has no evidentiary power, lacking the kiyum shtaros, and therefore, because they can't do it, so then that makes it a worthless shtar, essentially. So now we should believe them, because of what they are saying is really not up against much opposition. Certainly not a migo negative, according to that. So it's a fascinating dynamic here. You see a lot of different possibilities of how this is playing out, and essentially what this is telling us is that a shtar has a certain inherent significance and a certain inherent validity to it, and that may not be in effect when the kiyum shtaros is not a valid process, and maybe their statement calls into question the whole kiyum shtaros that's being involved here. Morty?
That would also mean that for you say that kiyum shtaros is going to be derabanan, that derabanan requirement would uproot them.
That's what it sounds like, or essentially it has the effect. I mean, Tosfos is certainly aware, it's Rabbanim, that's part of their language, right? That they said it's Shrichu Chachamim. But the effect of that is that essentially the shtar is not in play. And essentially you don't have a shtar that's going to testify to the kashrus of the Eidim at the time of the song. So you shouldn't say that it's amigo neged eidim. It's not amigo neged eidim. It's amigo neged something else, whatever level of credibility you want to give to that. So we're just about out of time. I just want to basically review. Essentially, today we had a table of contents. We were kind of identifying what are the many sugyas that are contained in the few lines of this Mishnah, and hopefully we'll have time to give a good attention to all of them, or as many of them as possible. So essentially, what sugyas did we identify here? So we identify the possibility that one can't sign a false star even Mishra Pikuach Nefesh. We identified the question of Ein Adam Meis Matzmo Rasha. We identified the question of Palgin and Diburin, which is related to that. We identified the question of Kevin Shehigin Shuvein Elchazer Amagin. The question of Migo Neged Eden and Pesha Asar Equal Migo, topic that we've already seen a little bit about. And the question of kiyum shtaros and the effect of kiyum shtaros, and all of that ties back into what exactly is the significance of the shtar, the halachic construct of the shtar, which we had to first figure out how does it survive a challenge from the mocker of VPN blowing the Kisavan. And now essentially what does that leave of standing? What exactly does that leave as the affirmative definition of the shtar, that with that, certain principles of Nemanis are put into play. So, God willing, we'll try to see how all of those sugyas play out and how they come together, and hopefully it should be an illuminating experience. I wish you all a wonderful day. See you tomorrow, like earlier, day one, day.